Welcome to the online ministry of Pacific Beach United Methodist Church, located in beautiful San Diego, California. Pacific Beach UMC is a member of the Reconciling Ministries Network and welcomes persons of all ages and backgrounds for worship, study, and service opportunities. More information can be found on our website at pbumc.org. May you be enriched in the hearing of these words, and may you receive and enjoy God's blessing.
Over the course of these last several weeks, we've been exploring, as I said earlier, we've been exploring stewardship. And this is a tradition of this congregation during the month of October. And one of the things that I know I've shared with you before, but one of the things that has been sort of a challenge for me as I've grown up in churches is sort of having that sense that the stewardship period is when the church is like the church's annual fundraising campaign. And I don't think that's what stewardship is. I don't think it can be that, because I think that if we look at stewardship just as the financial piece, then honestly we're missing the full picture. The ways that we talk about stewardship, certainly in this congregation, and I would argue in most United Methodist churches, has to do with a fuller expression of stewardship by supporting the ministries of a congregation with our prayers, our presence, our gifts, our service, and our witness. You see, if we only look at stewardship as the financial piece, then we're missing out on a fuller expression of what stewardship can be. It really is a sense of giving ourselves in profound and sacrificial ways in support of the ministries of a church. It's so much more than writing a check. But also, it's not just prayers. It's not just showing up in church on Sunday morning. You see, a full expression of stewardship is our prayers and our presence and our gifts and our service and our witness. I think a full expression of stewardship has to be all of those things. And so that's largely what we talked about the first Sunday of October as we entered into this conversation about stewardship. And then for the last couple of weeks, we've been asking some good questions, I think. Questions about how the world measures lives and how Christ calls us to measure our lives. You may remember that 2 weeks ago we talked about how sometimes our lives are measured by statistics, by numbers, by perhaps tables, right? And sometimes we can think about this in terms of athletes, right? Athletes are measured by baskets or goals or touchdowns or tackles or steals, right? People who enjoy the sport of fishing might be measured in terms of the size of a catch or the number of fish that are caught, right? People who are in business might be measured by sales numbers or commissions. Sometimes families are measured by the number of children that they have, right? How many ways does the world measure us by these numbers, by these statistics? And is that really the way that our lives should be measured? But then we looked at the parable of the soils that Jesus tells. Some people know it as the parable of the sower. I prefer the Common English Bible, the headline is the parable of the soils. The parable that talks about the seed that lands in different kinds of soils and how do those seeds grow and how do those seeds bear fruit. And we talked about how perhaps we might think about that the ways that our life might be measured, the ways that Christ invites us to measure our lives are not about those statistics, but instead about how we bear fruit. About how we take in the seeds that are planted within us and how we nurture that seed and how we offer that seed an opportunity to grow so that we can share it. And the way it is in the parable, some will bear 30-fold and 60-fold and 100-fold. We looked at that image of a grain of wheat that comes from one seed but then has all these others. It's bearing fruit. It's throughout the Gospels and even Paul's letters, the idea of bearing fruit. Then last week we talked about another way that sometimes the world will measure us, and it's about expressions of wealth. And some of us might think about that in terms of, you know, the size of a bank account, but there are other symbols of wealth, and sometimes that's about the kind of car that you drive, or the kind of house that you live in, or it might be where you live, right? Like location, or the style in which you dress, or the kinds of things that you choose to do. Very often, those are expressions of wealth, and the world can have a tendency to measure us based on those expressions of wealth, those measures of wealth. But then we ask ourselves, well, is that the right way for us to be measured? And how does Christ teach us? We talked about how perhaps Christ teaches us not to be, not that the value of a person can be found in the size of their bank account or their expressions of wealth, but instead about how they are generous, not just financially, but emotionally and spiritually. And how we can, by entering into those kinds of relationships that build others up, perhaps that's the kind of generosity where we might be measured. I don't know if you remember a couple of weeks ago, and it really covers both of these, but a couple of weeks ago I gave you that homework assignment. Do you remember that? You have your pennies in your pocket? Good. I don't have pennies. I have guitar picks. Now, I just want to say something. If you ended up giving your pennies to Umcor, that's okay. You can get more pennies. That's okay. I told you I use guitar picks. And I found, let me back up a little bit. If you don't know what the homework assignment was, it was this. It was take a few pennies or some other symbol and put them in one pocket, okay? And then engage in some kind of sacrificial love for someone. And the examples we gave a couple of weeks ago might be, you know, you notice a coworker is having a hard day, and so you say, you know, maybe let's sit down and have a conversation. Let me just listen to you and check in with you and see how you're doing. And there are other ways to enter into that kind of giving of oneself to someone that aren't necessarily financial, but just in terms of being a presence that's not measured by statistics or by money. And so the way I told you about it was you might have one of three things in your pocket. And so when you take a few minutes to do that, just move one of those things to the other pocket. And that's the way that you can keep track. And the challenge, the reason there's three, the challenge was do this three times in a week. And if you hit that goal of three times in a week, that's 156 lives that you get to touch over the course of a year. Because remember, part of that challenge is do that for a year. Do that until next October. Now, sometimes I don't get through all three of my guitar picks in a week. Sometimes I only get two. But still, that's 104 lives in a year that are touched by sacrificial love. So I would invite you, whether you're using pennies or guitar picks or something else, to continue doing this over the course of the year. And I hope to remember to check in with you and see how that's going for you. This is a way that we can bear fruit, a way that we can show love. But today I want to talk about a different measure, one of the ways that the world has a tendency to measure us. Frankly, I think this unit of measure is dangerous. See, it's the measure of power. Now, we like to think that we have power over our own lives, and it's my hope that most of us do. Have power over our own lives. But sometimes we're placed in circumstances where we have power over additional lives as well. And sometimes that takes the form of a promotion at work, right? Where you might oversee a few people where you have some power over their lives. And sometimes that's just in terms of, you know, writing a good review or a bad review. Sometimes it has to do with decision-making about whether or not that person gets a raise. Sometimes it has to do with decision-making over disciplinary actions in case they make a mistake or make a poor decision. Sometimes people are placed in positions of power over a great number of people. You might be, I know there are people involved in this congregation who are business owners, which, you know, most of us small business, but there's, you know, there's an element of power that comes with that. And how do we use that power? There are CEOs of organizations who have thousands and thousands of people working under them. You may now or may before have served in the armed forces, and if you get a promotion, then there's some folks who are serving under you, and you have an expression of power over those people. Right? There are lots of ways that we are given power beyond a power over our own selves. And there are also expressions in the world of people taking power away from others. I think particularly of the growing conversations about the sexual harassment of women. Right? That's not about sex, that's about power. Power can be a difficult thing for us to have responsibly. And in the words of what I would say is a great theologian, but also comic book writer, with great power comes great responsibility. There's an English historian that is known as Lord Acton, and he writes a particular thing that may be a familiar quote to you. He writes, "Power has a tendency to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." And maybe we've seen that around the world, certainly throughout our history, where those who find themselves in positions of absolute power, like it seems, I think this is where Lord Acton is going with this quote, it seems like when we get that sense of power, we get greedy for more. We want more power and more power and more power. We have control over all these people and all these lives, and that can have a tendency to guide us into a place of temptation. And in that place of temptation, we can do some pretty terrible things. Some things in our history that we might see as the Holocaust. Some things in our history that we can see as the Armenian Genocide. There are horrible things that have taken place in our history by people who have had power and have used that over other people. But it's not always on sort of a world war kind of scale or on that kind of a violent scale. But, you know, there are times that people wield power in ways that are inappropriate. I don't know if you've ever heard of someone by the name of John Henry Patterson. John Henry Patterson was the head of an organization. He was from the late 18th into early 19th century. John Henry Patterson was born in 1944, 1844, died in 1922, but he was the head of National Cash Register, if you know that organization, right? Not a whole lot of that organization around now, but maybe you've heard of that organization. Did amazing things in terms of business, and he was a fantastic salesperson. But in business folklore, do you know the story goes that he is the originator of the term, "you're fired"? I don't know if you've heard this story. I couldn't find like a legit source for this, but like business folklore tells it this way, that when he would get frustrated with somebody, maybe they did something they shouldn't have done, or they didn't do something they should have done, or maybe he was just mad at them that day, I don't know. But here's what he would do. Here's how he would respond. You see, he'd send them out of the office for something, a sales call or something else, and then while they're gone, he'd take their desk and he'd put it outside in front of the building. Now, this was easier to do on the first floor than it would be on a second floor. So if it was on the second floor, he'd just throw it out the window. And then, not until that person was coming back to the office, when that person was coming back, he'd pour kerosene on it and set it on fire. Do you see where the expression comes from? You're fired. This was not some creative and fun way to say someone, "you've lost your job today." Maybe that was his perspective, I don't know. But it doesn't feel like that. Like if you're coming back from a sales call and this is your desk and it's been doused with kerosene and set on fire, like that's an act of humiliation. That's an act of inappropriate power taken over someone else. Now, I'm not saying that John Henry Patterson is a horrible person. I'm saying that this particular practice, this particular use of power was inappropriate. But there are other more recent CEOs that we may know who have been terribly successful, wonderfully successful, I should say, but who have engaged in some pretty difficult practices. I love me my Apple products, but Steve Jobs was a difficult guy to work for. There are stories about people who would find themselves on the elevator with Jobs and not have a very good experience. But if we understand that power can have a tendency to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely, then we might understand the root of some of these things, and we might take it as a cautionary tale on ourselves. When we find ourselves in positions of power, how do we use it? I've been particularly grieved this week as people have used power, not on this grand scale, but on somewhat of a smaller scale, but used power in horrible ways toward other people, particularly people who are different from them. It was early this last week that two African-American persons were shot outside a Kroger grocery store, with all indications being because they were black and the person with the weapon was not. We have, as a nation, been shocked at someone mailing explosives to people who have different political ideas than they do. And your heart may have broken as mine did at the news of the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, where a person with a history of anti-Semitic social media posts went in during a bris ceremony, an extremely holy time in the life of a faith community, and killed 11 people. My heart breaks. And yet, as we think about power and how we use power, we might not only look at those who would wield power inappropriately, we might also think about our response and whether or not there is an appropriate response, and how do we live out that appropriate response, and what it is we're supposed to even do spiritually and emotionally with this news. I saw, speaking of social media, I saw a post that was a helpful thing for me. And it turns out I don't have the quote to show you, but I want to read it to you. This is a reading from the Talmud, which you may know is another source of learning from our Jewish friends. And it reads in this way: "Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief." I need that sentence again. Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. You are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it. My friends, we must not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. We must do justly now. We must love mercy now. We must walk humbly now. We are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are we free to abandon it. See, how is it that Jesus would ask us to measure our lives? Is it by expressions of power? Or is it by living our lives in such a way that we show that we have been transformed by the love of Jesus Christ? You know, this is not a new question, these questions about power. Jesus was pushing back against the religious elite, the Pharisees, the scribes. And we might see in some of those stories that there were folks who were using power inappropriately, but Jesus' disciples even weren't completely free of this temptation toward power. There are several places in the Gospels where Jesus' disciples were trying to use power inappropriately, where they were asking that question, who is the greatest? Mark 9, verses 30 and 37, there's an argument about who's the greatest, where Jesus brings in a child and says, this is who's the greatest. Matthew 23, Luke 22, and John 13 all have a parallel verse. John 13 is where Jesus is at the Last Supper. He's about to wash the disciples' feet, an example of service. But Matthew 23 and Luke 22 share a quote that's also in that that 13th chapter of John. And the quote goes like this: "Servants aren't greater than their master, nor are those who were sent greater than the one who sent them." And then there's the text that I'd like for us to consider today, from the 10th chapter of the Gospel of Mark. This is a few verses Excuse me for a moment. This is a few verses. This is what's in our scripture today. James and John, Zebedee's sons, came to Jesus and said, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They said, "Allow one of us to sit on your right and the other on your left when you enter your glory." Now when the other 10 disciples heard about this, they became angry with James and John. Jesus called them over and said, "You know that the ones who are considered the rulers by the Gentiles show off their authority over them, and their high-ranking officials order them around. But that's not the way it will be with you. Whoever wants to be great among you will be your servant. Whoever wants to be first among you will be the slave of all. For the human one didn't come to be served, but rather to serve and to give his life to liberate many people." I'm sure we've talked about James and John before. Do you remember their nickname? Do you remember their nickname? They're the Sons of Thunder. They're the sons of Zebedee. Now, Zebedee, the way scholars understand who Zebedee is not a poor person. Zebedee has some social influence, some social power. He has riches. And so you might imagine that James and John are people who have grown up with an idea of what it looks like to have power. And so as they see this one, as they see this Messiah, as they see this Christ, who is teaching and leading and doing profound things as the general understanding of what the Messiah would be like, would be the sort of Davidic, army kind of king who would rid the Jerusalem area of Romans occupying power. James and John wanted to see themselves as adjacent to that power. We all know what it's like to know people who want to be power adjacent. James and John wanted to be with Jesus in that sense of power. And Jesus said, "I think there's another way that you need to think about this." What's interesting to me is the scripture doesn't tell us why the disciples are mad at him. It only says that they're mad. Now, on my happy days, I want to say, well, the disciples are mad because they know that wanting to be adjacent to Jesus' power in that way is inappropriate. But on my more cynical days, I wonder if the disciples were angry at James and John because they wanted to ask that question, because they wanted to have that power. I'm not sure which it is. The text doesn't tell us. But Jesus says we got to look at it a different way. You know, over the course of the last couple of weeks, I've asked you to write something in that notes section on the back of your bulletin, and I'd like you, if you're willing, to write this down. Maybe you've already been taking notes, and maybe you haven't, but I'd like you to write something down. A couple of weeks ago, we wrote down the word love on the back of our bulletins, and then last week, we wrote down the word generosity on the back of our bulletins, and today, I'd like you to write down the word service. See, sometimes the world has a tendency to tell us that if we have enough power, that gives us cultural value. But Jesus tells us we must be servants to all. We must give of our lives and our energy and serve our neighbors. How do we know this? Think about the parable in Matthew 25 where Jesus is talking about on the last day when people are together that they will be divided as sheep and goats. You've probably heard this parable before. And the ones who are the goats are like, "Well, why are we in the group that you're speaking negatively about?" And Jesus says, "Because you didn't feed me when I was hungry. You didn't give me something to drink when I was thirsty. You didn't visit me when I was sick and in prison." And they said, "Well, when did we not do that?" Jesus said, "As soon as the very moment you didn't do that for any who are the least of my sisters and brothers, you didn't do it for me." And the folks who were in the group that's labeled the sheep, the group that Jesus was speaking positively about, "Well done." And they said, "Well, when do we do this good stuff? When do we do something good that you're talking about?" Jesus said, "As soon as you brought drink to those who were thirsty, brought food to those who were hungry, as soon as you visited those who were sick and in prison, as soon as you did that for the least of our sisters and brothers, you did it for me." It seems to me that our gospel compels us. I think I prefer the word invites us, calls us to live in such a way that Jesus matters, that love matters, so that we are transformed into people who are servants for the world. I can't think of another way to live in the world. Some of my favorite pastors and leaders call themselves servant leaders. Don't try to take on the power, but look at their role as leaders to be servants to those who lead. And I wonder if we might all envision ourselves as servant leaders. You know, there are some servant leaders in this congregation who continue to blow me away. One of the folks that I've been thinking about over the course of this week is Dick Versteeg. I'm pretty sure Dick Versteeg is here more hours of the week than I am. He climbs up on the roof. I don't know if you know this. Dick climbs up on the roof to open and close these windows. You know how he does it? He brings two ladders right over here to sort of the corner where the roof is. Do you know why he brings two ladders? He puts one up against the building and then carries the other one up onto the roof, because then he climbs up to the peak here and he puts it down the other side to climb down that ladder to open and close these windows. He comes and he helps with the financial stuff. He fixes the sprinklers. Dick Versteeg is a servant leader in this congregation. You know another servant leader in this congregation? Steve Frank. Steve Frank and his husband Russ would be at Project Grace every single Wednesday night. They love to pour milk for people and talk to people as they were carrying their plates of food and build relationships. Steve was also active in our Interfaith Shelter Network. Steve has a servant's heart. Steve is a servant leader. Now, I highlight these two people, but there are lots of folks who are servant leaders in this congregation, and it's a beautiful thing to see and experience. But did you know that there are still ways that we can support the ministries of the church by being servant leaders ourselves? Yes, I think it's important to be servant leaders around our communities and around our neighbors and around our vocations, but we have needs for servant leaders here in our congregation, and one of those that's a really tangible thing is coming up this week, and so you have an opportunity already. Every time there's five Wednesdays a month, which only happens a few weeks a year, that fifth Wednesday, it is our congregation's commitment to host our Wednesday night Project Grace meal. That's this Wednesday. I hope you'll come. And one of my favorite times is when we have too many volunteers in the kitchen, so people have to sit down at a table and share a meal with someone and treat them like they're an actual human being. If that's not servant leadership, I don't know what is. And so we have an opportunity this Wednesday to engage in some servant leadership with our community. But there are a few more opportunities, and I'd like to share with you some of those. I mentioned Project Grace. We have a number of committees that need some help. You know, this is the season where we're getting ready for our charge conference. Our charge conference is coming up next month. And part of what we do is we elect some servant leaders. And we have a need of some folks on our board of trustees. We need at least six people for our board of trustees. And that's anyone who might have experience with real estate or construction kinds of things. If you have experience with those things, please talk to me or talk to someone on our nominating committee, because we'd love to chat with you. We have need of a few folks on our staff parish relations committee, which is like personnel. So if you have some experience in human resources, things like that, we have some need of some folks like that. We have some need of folks on our nominating committee. If you are someone who does a good job at sort of getting to know folks pretty quickly and getting to know their gifts and skills and having conversations and making connections, we have a need of some folks in that way. We have a need of someone to chair our Growing in Faith Committee. Our Growing in Faith Committee covers worship and education. So if you can lead a good meeting, that's a place that we need some help. If you are good at coordinating advertising and public relations, we need some help. If you have some gifts and skills in being a bookkeeper, our finance committee needs some help. If you are good at sort of long-term visioning, we have a VUE committee, Visioning, Uniting, Expanding, where we'd love to hear your voice on that committee. There are lots of ways beyond what you might observe in your neighborhood, in the world, in your vocation. There are lots of ways that you can be that kind of giving and generous spirit of service here in this congregation, and there are so many more. I believe that we are called to give of our service. I believe that Jesus invites us to do these things. And so I invite you into a covenant. I invite you into a covenant, and I'd like you to join me as we close. I'd like you to join me in a prayer. And this is a prayer that was written by the founder of the Methodist tradition, who is John Wesley. And he wrote what is what we now call the Wesley Covenant Prayer. And I'd like you to join me in this prayer. We might say it together, and we might consider this our closing. And so I invite you to join me in this prayer together. I am no longer my own, but yours. Put me to what you will. Rank me with whom you will. Put me to doing. Put me to suffering. Let me be employed for you or laid aside for you. Exalted for you or brought low for you. Let me be full. Let me be empty. Let me have all things. Let me have nothing. I freely and wholeheartedly yield all things to your pleasure and disposal. And now, glorious and blessed God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you are mine and I am yours. So be it, and the covenant now made on earth, let it be ratified in heaven. Amen. Friends, I'd like to invite you into a time of thoughtfulness, of prayerfulness, of meditation, as we might consider how God is speaking to us through this time of worship today. Let us join in a time of prayer. Holy God, we are glad for this time to gather as this community of faith, to share our challenges, to share our struggles, to share our joys, to share our in-betweens. As we are gathered as a community of faith, we find strength, we find comfort, we find joy, we find peace, we find laughter, we find supportive embrace. This day we lift up the prayers of your people, of this congregation. Oh God, we lift up a prayer for the people of the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, and for people in general to value the importance of different religious and cultural groups. God, we lift up a prayer that compassion and unity, a prayer for compassion and unity in our country, with the assertion that kindness matters. God, we lift up all these things and any that are left unsaid. As we join together in the prayer, talk to us by your Son, our Christ, as we say, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.